Is this a common market correction or a start of a bear market?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, man, it's been kind of a crazy week in the market, and people are asking, is this just a correction? Are we headed for the bear market? Is a recession coming? I'm getting all sorts of questions from people this week. how are you seeing things?
Well, I hate to say it, but kind of all of the above. So, I mean, that ought to be a pretty confusing answer. Let me see if I can drill down and explain that a little bit. In the short run, yes, I think it's a correction. And part of me saying maybe we've hit the low for that correction. We'll see. The market got very oversold in the short run. You know, the Ned Davis guys has some charts going back 15, 20 years. And they pointed out that whenever the short-term oversold, and for those of you, again, investment lingo, when something's oversold, you can always imagine kind of like if you took a beach ball and pushed it under the water, there's a point in time when it says, okay, that's as far down as I'm going to go. The pressure from the beach ball pops up to the surface again. And so my guess is we might have a short-term low in place. We will see. The problem is you can't really predict what's going on because you can't predict what Donald Trump's going to do. President Trump, you know, is part of me says he delights in leaving everybody uncertain and confused. And I think that's part of his shtick and part of what he likes. If we are at a short-term low in the market, here's what you normally would see. There's four steps. Ned Davis did a really good job of outlining this. We just did a webcast this morning. Four steps of the market, and he said it's one of the most oversold readings we've had in the stock market in 10 years. Number one, the market gets very oversold. We've accomplished point one. Point two, we have a bit of a rebound. Now, we have a rebound going on today. While we're recording this show, we don't know it'll last through the end of the day. My guess is it probably will, now that they've announced that the government shutdown is not going to be an issue. And you usually have a rebound. Then oftentimes you have a retest of the low. Now, lately, several times we've had corrections in the last year or two. The Wall Street computer algorithms have kind of negated the test of the low. I mean, historically, most of the time when you have bottoms, significant bottoms in particular, you bounce, then you go back down and test the lows, and everybody goes, okay, if the lows hold, then you're over. Then the
thing looks like a W.
Yeah, it looks like a W instead of a V. And so when you have these V-shaped bottoms, like we had one last summer after the Japanese yen debacle, carry trade unwound, the market really never did go back and test the low again. It bounced, it dropped a little bit, then it went back up even further. And I think part of that is also because we're in a bull market and have been in a bull market. And the real question, the newsletter that would never get finished right now is what I'm working on, is are we in a bear? Have we turned the corner into a real bear? So these are the steps that normally happen when you're in a bull market. They may not happen this way if we're beginning of a bear market, but usually you have a retest of the lows, and then you have what's called a breadth thrust. Breadth meaning width of something, and when you have a really huge spike in the number of stocks going up, like 10 to 1 usually is a good number, where you have one day where the market's just off to the races. And so everybody's decided, okay, wow, the short-term fear's over. The deleveraging for the short run is over. Now we're going to go back up. And we could still have one of those, regardless of whether we're in a transition period into a bear or whether we're not. So the vast majority of people right now are still very bullish on the market. If you look at the characteristics, so we've got this extreme short-term pessimism that may have run its course for the short term. My concern, though, is I think we also could be and have seen what we call a cyclical top. Now, you have cyclical bull markets, you have secular bull markets and bear markets. I think we've hit a cyclical top. At this point, while the jury, I would say, is still out, my concern is that we have a cyclical top, meaning it may be a top for 6 months, 9 months, or even a year. I would say 9 months would be a good guess, because I think there's going to be more fireworks coming in the next few months. Especially the biggest risk to me, more than anything, more than what the government's doing, more than the Doge, more than the job cuts, and all that stuff is going to play into this, I still think, is Iran. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But right now, we expected some post-election choppiness. That's sort of normal. Earnings estimates, though, stocks, again, are based on the earnings. The long-term values on stocks typically revolve around whether the earnings are accelerating and going up or not. Earnings were projected at the end of the year. They were saying 14% a year earnings growth for the next 12 months. Last I've seen is now down to 7.25%. The GDP growth numbers, all the analysts, Wall Street, you name it, they're cutting. Instead of saying 2 or 2.5% growth, they're saying 1 to 1.5% growth this year. Inflation is still relatively high. So the Fed is not off the hook yet in terms of lowering interest rates. That's what everybody's hoping for. But they might be a little stubborn. My experience, if you remember back to 2018, Trump and Powell have not always gotten along. Matter of fact, they were kind of opponents there for a while in 2018, until finally Powell decided to go along with Trump. That's at least the way it looks from behind the scenes. We don't know what happened in the inner sanctum of the rooms. But the bottom line is, it looked like the Fed was inducing a recession. And then finally, they decided to lower rates and everything turned around. But inflation is not defeated at this point. The transitory 2% inflation rate, which is what everybody says is the goal, is to get inflation back down to 2. I think that's a fantasy. I don't see us getting there. Probably not again in my lifetime. That 2% number we reached in the previous decade because of a historic bust in 2008 and in 2009. And then the after effects of all that deleveraging and all that deflationary pressure that we had. So inflation, it had its big spike, then it came back down, and it's not going to shoot back up into the 9-10% or even in the high double digits and the low double digits. It could do that before the decade's over, but it's not going to do that in the short run. So the bottom line is, inflation is kind of dormant, but it's kind of sneaking back up just a little bit. If you look at the stocks, and here's what I want to do, is contrast what's going on in the short run with what's going on in the long run. The percentage of stocks above their 200-day moving average has fallen significantly. But here's some of the things that you need to know. Right now, we're about earlier today when I was doing the calculations, NASDAQ was about 4.5% below the 200-day moving average. Why do we care about the 200-day moving average? Is that a magic number that when the market goes below that, it's automatic bear? Or above it, it's an automatic bull? And the answer to that is not really. But it tends to be a very good, what we call demarcation kind of zone. So the market frequently in a bull market, when you're in a bull market and the rising tide's lifting all the boats and you're going to higher highs, higher lows and going up, occasionally you'll cross that 200-day moving average, which again is real simple. You take the most recent 200 days, and every day you update it with a new date and throw the old date out. So it's hence a moving average. It moves through time. As the market goes up, then the moving average, the oldest date is thrown out, the newest date is plugged in. But it tends to be a very good demarcation zone on when you're in a bull or when you're in a bear. If you're not just dipping your toe in the water kind of thing, we barely crossed it and it surged back up again. And you could make the case, if the market can jump back above, and I'm saying, let's say the next 60 days-ish, if the market could jump back above that 200-day moving average significantly, then you might have to say, well, maybe the quote theory, the bear market might be over if you were headed toward a bear. Right now, I'm looking at most of the things that I see, both for the long and short term, as possible mega tops for this market cycle. Now, do I think we're heading to a new 2008? No, I don't. But let me show you some things that are more...
Real quick, you said a top for this market cycle. How long is this cycle you're referring to?
In other words, we had a bottom in 2022. Then we had a rally in 23 and 24. If we have another bear of some sort, some magnitude, that's going to that will comprise a cycle. I'm not talking about the hyper long-term outlook, if you will. But if you do look at those very, very long-term trends, that's one of the things that leads me to believe that maybe we've hit a cyclical top in the market. Maybe we hit a top, maybe we don't go back up there right away. Although I'm guessing, again, I think that there's going to be more damage to the economy than most people are anticipating with all the layoffs and all the stuff with the Trump and all the trade and all that. We'll get to the economy a little bit more in just a moment. But let's take a look at the long-term things, things that these would be kind of, if you want to say, I'm going to get my list to check the boxes. Okay, what are some things that indicate that maybe this is a significant top that we've just had in the market, not just a short-term technical thing? So in other words, there's two scenarios from here. Scenario one is the market has gone down. Maybe we're putting in a short-term low. Then you have a bounce. Then usually you test the lows on these more significant corrections. Then you start rising and you just take off again. Back into the happy days are here again. Now we're back in the bull market. That's one scenario. Another scenario is we have choppiness, bounce, we have a bounce, we have maybe more downside, not necessarily lower lows, but testing those old lows. And then there's more market turmoil, more economic turmoil. It does appear from my perspective that Trump has decided he's going to take whatever medicine the economy needs this year, because next year will be the midterm elections. And Trump knows that if things aren't working swimmingly well by November of next year, then he's going to be a lame duck. And that's not what he's shooting for. He's trying to make long-term changes in America for the future, for the next generation, not just the short-term political cycle. And when I read an article recently, Bessette, you know, the Treasury Secretary, was interviewed by a number of journalists. That was the same impression I got from him. He's like, okay, there's going to be, he called it a period of detox, where we're detoxing the country, the economy, from being reliant on government spending to being reliant on booming the private sector, which in the long run is absolutely what we need to do. What Elon Musk is doing with Doge, I mean, we're talking about huge cuts in terms of the number of people that are likely to be losing their jobs, the number of people already that have taken, you know, packages for retirement from the government. That's a big change of direction. That's not going to be something that just short term blows over in the short run and, oh, well, everything's just fine. That's most likely going to cause more turmoil. So when I look at the cause and effects of what I see as the bull market that we've been in, and again, you can look at it as a secular bull going all the way back to 2009. That's the very, very big picture. You can look at these shorter term corrections as cyclical bulls and bears, which this one's been in an uptrend 23 and 24, and it may be over now. We'll see. But if I look at backups, because a lot of times you get the best picture, and matter of fact, most of the time you get the best picture about reality and what is really going on in the marketplace and the economy, if you can take the 30,000 foot altitude view. I still remember once, it's very interesting, one of the flights, I can't remember, I fly a lot to different places for due diligence trips and so forth, and there was one time I was flying in the plane, and I noticed it looked like this giant spotlight was on the ground. And it was following us. I'm like, how is that possible? There's right. A giant spotlight on the ground, and it's following us.
I've seen something like that, too. Yeah.
Anyway, and I finally put two and two together. I'm like, oh, the moon is reflecting off the side of the airplane and creating this giant spotlight effect. I mean, this is bigger than, those of us that are older remember back in the day when they had the World War II spotlights that they used. So if you had an opening of a new store, they'd bring these giant spotlights out that they used that Americans bought, which they never had to use because we weren't invaded in America. But they had them just in case the Japs or the Germans came in and tried to bomb America. They had their spotlights that they could shine up in the sky. Anyway, so sometimes it's helpful to look at it from the 30,000 foot altitude. So again, what are some things that make me think this might have been the top, not necessarily forever, but for this cycle? Here's a few of them. Number one, household stock holdings. So how many people that in a household financial assets, what are they in terms of how much do they have in terms of stocks compared to other financial assets? The peak prior to this was in 2000. And if you remember 2000, 2000 was
the dot-com bubble. When everybody you talked to had a great stock to buy.
Oh, I know. And it was a pandemic of stock frenzy. At that time, the highest percentage of household financial assets and stocks was 44.9%. So right at, let's just call it 45%. That's pretty high, you know, than other assets like bonds, etc. This time, over 48%. So we've had an all-time high in the percentage of household financial assets that are in stocks. Now, the old saying goes, when everybody in a bull market is bought and there's nobody left to buy, then that's usually the top of the cycle. Here's another chart. We're, by the way, the newsletter that would never get finished, a lot of these are going to go in this new newsletter, which I'm hoping to get it finished next week. But got to get it finished sooner or later. I have to do it before April, just at least for my own peace of mind. Anyway, the long-term trend looks like it's in bubble territory. So now I'm looking at valuation. So first, I was looking at what percentage of households have money in stocks, what percentage are in stocks, highest on record. Shouldn't be surprising. Again, this is not something you say, yeah, well, you would expect that because the Dow or the S&P is at an all-time high. No, this is a percentage. It's not a raw number. It's a percentage of stocks. Then you look at the longer-term trend, and I'm reading from Ned Davis earlier in the year. Long-term trend looks extended and in, quote, bubble territory. What's a bubble? Bubble is one of those things you don't want to ride back down if this is a bubble. He said, we have many charts showing prices and valuations are very high compared to the historical trend. This one, which is going to go into the next newsletter, which you have, if you haven't signed up for, if you're not on our mailing list, please go to our website to sign up for it. The S&P is trading above the upper trend channel and only done that two times in history before. So if you draw a trend line that goes back to the 1920s and you draw a trend channel, which is the channel is kind of the stock market bounce up and down, up and down, up and down in this long-term uptrend channel, and it hits the top and it hits the bottom, hits the top, hits the bottom. There's only been three times when you've blown out of that channel to the upside. First one was in 1929, and we know what happened after that. The second one was in 2000 under the dot-coms, and the third one is today. So if I'm looking at really big picture stuff, I'm like, this makes me think maybe we're at a long-term top in the market, although I'm hopeful that if we do have a recession, that to me would cinch the deal, but that's not going to show up for a while. But my hope would be it'd be a shorter-term deal, not a long-term. I just don't see the reason for a, quote, secular bear market lasting over a decade. I think it's a cyclical bear market probably that we're going to be at. The price-to-book value ratio for the S&P 500 is also at a record high. It's slightly above where it was in 2000. Price-to-sales ratio is at a new high, higher than it was 2 years ago, way higher than it was in 2000. I may have mentioned this earlier, but mutual fund cash relative to their cash holdings is at a record low. Lowest number in the history of mutual funds, which goes back to the 1920s. The second lowest number was, guess what, at the dot-com era in 2000. So right now you have extremely low cash on hand in the mutual funds. And it kind of, again, what happens when you get to the point where everybody's bought is going to buy for the cycle? That's the top. What about rising consumer expectations for the stock market? The Conference Board reported that consumers about their attitudes towards stocks. The latest survey showed the record bullish outlook on stocks, which historically, again, has been bearish for stocks. This is from Ned Davis. So in other words, if I look at the percentage of consumers that are bullish on stocks, it is significantly higher than it's ever been. Well over 50% of the people polled, and it's never gotten anywhere close to that. Highest it's ever been is 45, and this is about 55. So much higher than before. If you stand back and look at the market, if you look at the stock market from the 30,000 foot altitude, not the short-term squiggle. So in other words, I would make the case we may have hit a short-term low. I wouldn't be surprised if we have hit a short-term low and get some sort of bounce. The question is, how sustainable will the bounce be? Will we go back and test the lows? Will we not? Will we have a big run after that if everything gets enough of a relief rally? Right now, there's so much uncertainty affecting the market that it's difficult for me to imagine a really big bull market right now. And again, to me, the biggest risk is still Iran, which again, we will talk about as we go in the show. But the bottom line is, I think we're probably at, if we haven't hit a short-term low in the market, we're probably near one. But normally, the market doesn't have just a straight cliff. You know, I don't know if you remember, Michael, if you're old enough to remember, you probably are because you had older brothers and sisters. But Wide, wide world of sports. Acapulco cliff diving. So these guys jump off a 200-foot cliff, and they land in a pool of water when the ocean, when, and you want to hit it when the tide's up, by the way. You want to hit it when the wave's high and not the wave's down. You're not at the you're at the top of the wave and not at the bottom of the wave, not at the trough. You're at the crest. And there's 12 feet to land and, you know, not hit the bottom for 12 feet. I'm like, whoa. So normally, the market doesn't have an Acapulco cliff dive. Occasionally you do, like 1987 was one of those, and it can still happen, but that's probably not likely to happen. So bottom line is, I think the trade disruptions are going to continue. Everything that I'm seeing, we just did a new update, and with Trump, it's everything can change in a second. You know, everything today, we see one thing, tomorrow we see something else. You know, you never know what's going to happen next. But the bottom line is that the trade issues look like they're going to continue until May or so, at least through May. So the question becomes, and this is where we kind of started this show. You mentioned this last week, Michael, so I'll give you a feather in your cap there. Will these trade disruptions cause a recession and a bear market? Has Trump decided, okay, we're going to have to take a lot of pain? That's what Bessette made it sound like. And Trump has made several comments to this effect as well. He's not out there broadcasting it wildly, but he has made these statements that, hey, there may be some short-term pain and short-term disruptions because we've got to get all this stuff out of the way. We've got to get the economy where it's not so dependent on government to make the economy run, more build up the private sector. So I still see it looks like we're going to have trade uncertainty at least through May and maybe through June. Again, I still think the biggest threat is Iran. We'll talk about that a little more in the second half of the show. So the uncertainty right now, it hasn't seemed to affect the consumers that much. Although if you were in the real estate industry like my daughter and you were dealing with single family home sales, you know, they have gone back down again to significantly lower levels. That's because consumers are more concerned about the bigger picture on the economy and getting laid off, but that's not a huge predominant issue right now. The bigger factor is corporate CapEx. What is CapEx? That's when corporations spend money for projects or whatever. It is not only slowed, it's becoming more pronounced. One analyst said they're slashing CapEx plans. Slashing is not a good idea. So here's the way the economy works. GDP typically is made up of close to 70% of GDP is consumer spending. So right now, these issues are not a big enough deal to cause a massive revolt on consumer spending at this point. Could they become that? Absolutely, they could. And I'm concerned they might, but between now and September or October. But corporations, while they're only about 10% of spending, because basically the economy is about 70% consumers, about 10% corporate spending, and the rest of that, the other 20%, is government of one sort, not federal government only, but federal, state, local governments. So the government entity part of the economy is about 20%. Now we're cutting that back, but the bigger issue of what is likely to be, and you got to remember, the economy shifts on the margin. What do I mean by that? Well, look at the stock market for an example. If you have 50% of the people that want to buy a certain stock and 50% want to sell, it should be theoretically flat. If you have 51% of the people that want to buy the stock and 49% want to sell, then it should go up a little bit. The stock market moves on the margin. The margin, the small margins for supply and demand make a huge difference for the market and the economy as well. So when you're dealing with the economy and you're looking at corporate CapEx, spending by corporations to build factories or grow their company or anything they do to grow whatever it is they produce, whether they're a technology company or construction company, doesn't matter. Corporate CapEx is a major lever. So in other words, it's only 10% of the spending. But if you can imagine having a 10-foot long crowbar and you got a big boulder you got to move, you got a lot of leverage when you get out on the end of that crowbar. If you've ever done any construction work, which I did going through college years ago, that was back when dinosaurs ruled the earth, you know. But anyway, bottom line is that leverage is a big deal. So you can have a big boulder, a long crowbar. It doesn't take, you know, 1,000 pounds of pressure to move that boulder. It just, you have a lot less than that because of the leverage involved with the crowbar. So the bottom line is corporate CapEx is a part of that leverage. And when it starts to slow, that's significant. The issue is for unemployment, as I mentioned, unemployment is almost certain not to peak till after September because a lot of the government employees that are taking the early buyouts won't show up. They're still showing up employed until their six-month contract is over. And then unemployment will go up some more, and unemployment looks like it's turning and starting back up again. So again, Bessette said a detox period. U4 is back up to 4.1. That's the standard measure of unemployment. But U6, which includes people that are, many of them are having to take part-time work instead of full-time work. U6 is a bigger, wider measure of unemployment. Spiked this last month from 7.5 to 8. So it looks to me like in the household survey, which is where they call households, see if you have a job, that also had a huge drop, 588,000. So it looks to me like the unemployment rate has turned and we're going straight back up again. I think a recession is headed our way.
All right. Well, we'd like to take just a moment to remind you how to learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services. Again, you can go to our website, cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. That's where you can sign up for our free newsletters that Jerry mentioned earlier, that he's working hard to get the never-ending newsletter to be ending, but he is working diligently to get it there. Just what with all this that's happening, he wants to make sure he's giving you up-to-date information. On our website, you can also catch previous broadcasts and interviews from our shows. If you want to go back and listen to those, if you missed one or want to encourage a family member to go listen, that's a good place to find them. Another good place to find our shows on a weekly basis and to catch some previous shows is through our podcast. Again, it's on all the major ones, Apple, your Spotify, your Amazon. You can go there and listen to the podcast of our show, which is called Jerry Tuma's Smart Money. So a lot of times if I just search for Jerry Tuma, T-U-M-A, it pulls right up. So again, you can podcast by looking for Jerry Tuma in the search engine. Again, it's Jerry Tuma Smart Money. For a free consultation, you can call us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. You know, if you're interested in an advisor who looks at the economy, looks at the markets, and adjusts the portfolios accordingly, we may be a good fit for you. We would hope you give us a call so that we can get to know you. Again, we have no pressure sales. We don't want you to be forced into anything. We just talk to you, and if it feels like a good fit, we'll keep talking and make sure it's a good fit for both sides, and then we'll go for it if it is. So again, you can reach us at 1-800-327-4285 or at cornerstonereport.com. All right, Jerry, well, before I took that little break to remind our listeners where they can find us, you were talking about unemployment, because it is, even when we are talking to Eric Basmajian from EPB Research, which that interview is also up on our website at cornerstonereport.com, he was talking about recently in his reports how unemployment's kind of the last tipping point that could push the economy into recession. There's a lot of things that were leaning that way, but unemployment was hanging on tight. But now it's kind of loosening up again and going up. So what do you see with unemployment?
Well, right now we are seeing the unemployment rate start to reaccelerate. So we had a brief pause. You know, unemployment went up to, I think 4.3, then it backed off to 4, and everybody's like, oh, the recession worries are over, happy days are here again, and well, I don't know, it doesn't quite look that way now. And by the way, I will say one thing. This, to me, you know, I've been doing this since 1980, so I've been through quite a few business cycles over that time. This, to me, is still the weirdest the weirdest cycle that I've ever seen, because there's been times when it's kind of like you pull up to the stoplight and you got a red, a yellow, and a green lights all flashing simultaneously. Like, wait a minute. And some of that was distortions because of COVID, which we've talked about ad infinitum over the past. But essentially, the unemployment rate, and I remember making this, you know, analogy back, I don't remember, sometime probably September, October, I said, okay, what happens in the economy, if you're riding a roller coaster and you're in the front car of the roller coaster, there's nobody else in front of you, you're in the front car, and you go over the top of the hill, you start looking at the hill and look down and go, whoa, that's a steep drop, and it's you're getting the heebie-jeebies, you know, your hair's starting to stand on end, because you're like, wow, that's pretty thrilling looking down. But then you go down very slowly at first, until finally what happens is you get enough of the cars on the positive slope side that's going down to outweigh the guys on the other side that are still going up. And all of a sudden, this thing just takes off like a rocket. Well, that still is a good analogy for me of what's going on with the unemployment rate. Now, I'm just looking at a chart here. And again, we're going to have a bunch of these in the newsletter if and when I ever get it finished. This is layoffs by Challenger. Challenger is a private company that also works in this sector. One of their specialties is the employment rate. And so we saw a huge spike in unemployment under COVID, obviously. We're now seeing another spike. Now, this is not including government jobs, I don't believe, but the spike is the highest since we've seen since 2009, if you exclude COVID. And it's just going straight up the page. So what's happening here is corporations, when they decide we're going to slow down or we're going to stop, or, you know, we're not going to spend more money, we're not going to expand right now, we're hunkering down for what could be a bad economy or a challenging economy or a fearful or uncertain. And we don't have to have a huge crash in terms of the recession necessarily. We could have a moderate recession. As a matter of fact, if the situation in the Middle East were more stable, I would make the case this is probably going to be a moderate recession, not a huge one. And, you know, it reminds me, and this cycle has always reminded me more of the 2000 era, the dot-coms. There was a lot of speculative fervor there. We've had a lot of that going on here. You know, as Yogi Bear's son Dale said when they were trying to get him to say Yogi-ism, he was trying to make it as a catcher in the Yankee system. They said, are you like your dad? He said, no, our similarities are different. You know, so we've had some different similarities to that market, this market and that market and so forth are similar. And I could make the case that unless we have something international break out, a big shock like the Middle East, this might be a short-term downturn that lasts for one or two calendar quarters and probably is fairly mild. Probably not a huge decline in the economy. I don't see that. In other words, right now, if you look back, and of course, a lot of the deal that we saw in 2008 was almost like a submarine that you didn't even know was there that torpedoed the ship. In other words, the issue was all of the subprime mortgage derivatives, which many of you remember that time, and I won't spend too much time going into all the details on that, but the subprime mortgage derivatives were investments that Wall Street peddled, if you want to call it that. They packaged together a whole bunch of subprime mortgages, assuming that housing prices would never go down, which was a really bad assumption, as we all know. 3 years, the housing market, actually 6 years from top to bottom on the housing market. Nationwide, we haven't had a nationwide housing decline of that magnitude since the 30s, but we had one. We were overbuilding and over owning and all that stuff and over leveraging housing during that period of time, which fit, by the way, the demographics perfectly. If you don't know or understand that part of the whole deal, go back and reread our book, the first part of our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond, the first part about the boom. And the boom was being driven by consumer spending by the baby boomers. And essentially, when they peaked out for their normal time slot, for what they would normally speak, and as the average person peaks for spending in terms of percentage of their budget, at least back then it was 44 years old. It might be a little older now because the whole housing situation has changed, but housing topped out then. But again, unfortunately, many of the Wall Street firms leveraged those subprime mortgages up to 30 to 1. And if you don't understand what a 30 to 1 leverage means, that means if you have a 4% decline in something that's levered 30 to 1, you lose several thousand percent of your money. You wipe out very quickly if you're levered 30 to 1. And it was a crazy time of greed and excess. And, you know, it'll go down in history. The history books will talk about it. Hopefully they'll get it accurate. But it was a wild, wild period of time. So we've seen those kind of crashes before. I don't right now see anything that would intimate to me, that would hint to me that anything of that magnitude would be coming. Right now, I don't see massive consumer imbalances. I don't see housing being grossly overpriced. Yes, it's gone up a lot, but that's shortage. We've had shortages of building. We've had shortages of building for housing since 2008. And now you got two generations, the Gen Zs and millennials, the two largest, replacing the largest of which used to be the baby boomers. Now the Gen Z and millennials are the largest generations in U.S. history that are coming into the age when they want to be starting to buy homes, and there's just not a lot of homes available right now. So the price being high is probably going to stay high, and it could reaccelerate in a couple of 3 years. I don't see interest rates going much lower than they are now, probably a little lower, depending on if we have a recession or not. So the bottom line is, it looks to me like we are probably going to have a mild recession unless and until you include geopolitical issues, and that simply could change everything. So right now, again, layoff announcements. Now, announcement is a corporation says we're going to do a layoff. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to follow through on it, but they usually do. So we've got higher inflation in the rising material costs and so forth, immigration and deportations. We don't know how that's going to affect everything, but in the short run, that's disruptive. Again, historically, construction industry, restaurants and hotels have a heavy dependence upon Hispanic workers and or people that might get deported. And that's gonna be felt in the marketplace. We have no clue how much that's going to affect things in the short run. But the bottom line is that we still have roughly 4%, 4.5% inflation. I don't think we're going to get to 2. I just don't see that happening. The layoff plans are starting to kick in, and it looks like that's going to accelerate. And it's not just because of DOGE. It's also because of the uncertainties in the marketplace. So what I'm seeing right now, and it looks to me like ADP, by the way, ADP is another, they do payrolls, and they're talking about a significant drop in employment because of what they're seeing. So it looks to me like we're entering a mild recession as we speak. And that mild recession, if I'm guessing, might last a couple of calendar quarters. Will it be negative for the first quarter? We're almost out of the first quarter. We'll know in a couple of 3 weeks. But second quarter doesn't look like to me it's going to be booming. And this could last all the way into the second half of the year. Now, the bigger issue to me, though, is what happens after that. So right now we have disruptions from the immigration deportation issue, which right now is not headline news. But I think it's going to be later. In other words, I would be shocked if Trump just decides, oh, well, I've been campaigning on this for several years. Now I'm going to change my mind and not deport anybody. No, he's going to continue. He's going to bring the deporting, you know, of the illegals out in the open, and it's going to be significant impact on the economy. Now, I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm not saying it's a good idea necessarily. I'm saying, hey, I don't think people should be able to come into our country illegally and work and never get citizenship. I think that is a bad idea. But the bottom line is, we're talking about what's the impact on the economy going to be. We're not talking about the political ramifications. We're not talking about the human element. We're talking about only the economic impact. And the economic impact is higher wages. Because if you lose a lot of people that are willing to work for substandard or low-end wages in our economy, and a lot of those people go away, guess what? There's not enough workers to fill those jobs that those people are habitating right now. And so what means you're going to have to pay a higher wage to get someone to come in and take their place. That's more inflation. That makes it tougher for the Fed to do its job. So the deportation thing is more inflation. A lot of the economists make the case that the trade war is going to cause deflation, or, you know, a temporary spike and then go away. Well, again, depends. Depends on what? If a corporation, because of the trade war, has to shift whatever it's buying from China to some other place, and the long-term ramification of that is the other place they're buying it from is going to charge a lot higher price than China. Now China's got a 25% tariff on it or whatever. And I'm just using as an example, I'm just pulling out of the air, but you can follow along with me on this. As an example, if you're sitting there and you've got a higher substitute, you're going to have to pay a higher price somewhere else to get the good, then I don't see how that becomes just a temporary spike of inflation. I think you could have a temporary spike and it will slow down some, but that if you have a permanent increase in the material cost, that again is more inflationary. So Michael, these are kind of, may you live in interesting times. I don't think any of us were expecting to have this many disruptions hitting the market and the economy all at one time. As a matter of fact, I remember back last September when I was talking about, I think this is the top of the cycle, and then I wrote the newsletter on it, Election Blues. Then after a while, I got, oh, okay, I had buyer's remorse. I just said, okay, I guess I missed it. I guess maybe I'm wrong. Well, now I hate to say it because I don't want to pat myself on the back, but now I'm looking back on, oh, well, you know, now it looks like what I wrote was right after all. So if you haven't gotten a copy of that newsletter, and if you haven't gotten a copy of the new one that I'm working on now, which I was hoping to finish today, but it's going to be next week probably, then you need to sign up on our website. Go to cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. Many of you may already be on the mailing list. My goal is to start writing much more frequently. That just depends on the schedule and what's going on in the world right now, what's going on in personal life and so forth. But the bottom line is I am working on a new newsletter. My plan is to get it out next week, come heck or high water. And so there's going to be charts on this because you've got to look at risks and rewards. In other words, are we in a position where it looks like the market is just at a temporary dip and everything is going to be fine between now and September, now and the end of the year? When I look at the risks, when I look at how overvalued the market is already, how over-leveraged it is and has been, when I look at mutual funds, record levels of low records on how much cash they have, more so than the dot-com era in 2000. When I look at the expectations of consumers being higher than it's ever been in the history of the market. Now, this survey goes back 50 years, and expectations for stock returns are the highest in 50 years. That's what we call a contrary opinion indicator. When everybody is on one side of the boat, it tumps over the boat. And the bottom line is that's a warning sign. That's a long-term warning sign. And we're not talking about short-term indicators here. We're talking about long-term. When you reach a point of valuation where you're popping at the top of a cycle of a trend channel that goes back to the 1920s, and you've only done that twice before, 29 and 2000, all of these things are pointing to me that this may be a historic top. I frankly don't expect it to be a humongous secular bear like we saw in 2008. I don't see that right now. I think the evidence still points to a slowdown, which will probably end up being an official recession happening before the end of the year. But if we don't get out of control in the Middle East, that's the way it could stay. If we get out of control in the Middle East, Wizard of Oz, that's a horse of a different color altogether. So we know, we interviewed Matt Gerken in the newsletter that we're putting out. It's going to have an extensive interview with Matt Gerken embedded in the newsletter. So Matt Gerken's going to talk to us about what's going on. And we've got all of his information available on the web. I'll let Michael give you that info in just a moment of that interview we did with him about a month or so ago. But Matt Gerken, if you're not familiar, he's my favorite geopolitical analyst. Now, geopolitics is not my specialty. I know enough to be dangerous, but the point is you've got to let geopolitics have a role in what's going on in the economy and the markets. And so right now, essentially what we're looking at is the trade wars. Those are geopolitical as well, but they're economics. But when you're talking about a war, and again, I'll just give you the information that I have as it stands right now. So step one, and this is right in the newsletter, or it's right in the interview. What we did was we transcribed the interview with Michael Gerken, and we're putting it in the newsletter. So it'll be a part of this next newsletter that comes out. And he shocked me, and I've told this story before, but it bears repeating. I was reading along. He's got five things that won't happen in this, you know, next in 2025. I'm like, okay. So I'm kind of reading it with a certain expectation in mind. I'm thinking, okay, there's things that are not likely to happen. So even though I'm reading and processing, because I do an enormous amount of research for all these shows and so forth, sometimes my reading stack is between 4 and 6 inches tall per week. That's a lot. That's a lot of reading and research, but I love doing it. You know, the Strength Finder test, many of you probably have taken it from Gallup, that one of the things that I came out strong on was researcher or learner. Anyway, so the point is this. I was kind of reading it half-heartedly because I'm like, okay, these are five things that won't happen this year in 2025. And he shocked me because he said, we're not going to have peace in the Middle East in 2025. I'm like, what? Wait. I had to do a double take and reread it. And he said, no, the odds he believes of having Israel decide to take out Iran in the calendar year of 2025, he places at a 75% odds. Now, the most recent quote that I have from President Trump is something's going to happen, quote, very, very soon. How soon is very, very soon? I have no idea. If you can predict Trump, you're better than me. But the point is, he's saying we cannot allow this situation to contend. I spoke to one of my longtime friends, and I will keep him nameless on this one because just in case he doesn't want this broadcast, but we were at the National Religious Broadcasters about 3 weeks ago now, and this guy has extensive connections into Israel and Israeli government. Matter of fact, his wife is related to Schindler of Schindler's List. That's how deep the roots go over there. And I asked him this, and he kind of got quiet on me and kind of like, okay, let's kind of move over to the side here. I don't want to broadcast this to everybody around me. He said, Jerry, what's going to happen? He said, the Israeli government has already decided they're going to take Iran out one way or another. Now, Matt Gerken made it sound this way. He said, Jerry, what do they do? Are they going to risk, what if we wait 5 or 6 years to try to take out Iran? Iran is basically an existential threat. They want to destroy Israel, period, over and out. If they're allowed to gain a nuclear weapon status, that's a complete game changer for Israel. And we do know, in this chart that Matt Gerken had in his newsletter, the reactors, the number of, I think it was centrifuges, they said we've gone from 200-300 of those to 12,000 of those since Trump was in office the first time. So it's clear the Iranian regime is under pressure internally. It's become a very unpopular regime with the population. There have been lots and lots of riots or demonstrations against the regime. The vast majority of the people that live there hate the regime. As a matter of fact, The Economist magazine did an article several years ago, and I'm sure it's gotten worse since then, and they said Iran is quickly becoming the most secular society in the Middle East. You see the pictures of the women, and they have headscarves on, but they're further and further back on their heads, so it's okay. I'm covering the back one quarter of my head with a scarf, but you know, no burqas or anything like that. And they said they used to blare the call to prayer over the loudspeakers everywhere. They stopped that because the people said it's disrupting my house. I don't like the massive noise. And on and on and on about how, quote, secular it appears to be going. At the same time, you're having quite a Christian underground revolution. And most of that's underground for obvious reasons, because people get their heads chopped off if you cross the wrong person in the Middle East. But the bottom line is, I think that's the bigger risk for the U.S. this year and for the U.S. economy. Now, would that disrupt things? Quite a bit. Iran has basically said, we're going to shut the Middle East. We're going to shut the Straits of Hormuz if we're attacked. The Houthis have kind of been playing it calm around the Red Sea area since Trump got in office. They'll go crazy. So this may not happen. Matt Gerken said it's a 75% probability. And I've never known him. He doesn't exaggerate. He's not a sensationalist. I've never heard him say anything like that in terms of that high of a level of predicting this is going to happen at 75%. I was flabbergasted when I reread it. I had to read it twice because I'm like, wait a minute. Did he just say what I thought he said? And then I went back. He did. So here's what I think we're going to face in this year, in 2025. I think we likely have started what we'll call, again, a cyclical bear market. I don't think it's a secular bear at this point, but I reserve the right to change my opinion later. What that means is a cyclical downturn. Think of the crash of 87. It was spectacular. It happened very quickly, but it was about a 30% drop from top to bottom. The top in August until the bottom in October was about a 30% drop. Nothing happened to the economy at all that year. It was almost 100% of it was program trading by too many people on Wall Street having the same computer system that issued sell signals at the same time. Okay, 2018, we had a near bear market. We had a bear market that was, again, Trump is having a headbutting contest with our good friend Mr. Powell at the Fed. Fed is cutting back on liquidity. They're cutting the quantitative easing, is going to quantitative tightening. They're raising rates. And all of a sudden, the market just starts going in a free fall. And the Treasury Secretary escapes my mind right now, the name of the Treasury Secretary from that era. He has a face-to-face meeting with Powell and company, and Powell and company decided to change their mind. Fed decided they were going to lower rates instead of continuing to tighten rates. And we were probably headed for recession if they hadn't turned it around, but they did turn it around. But that was about a 20% drop in 2018. So again, I'm not expecting a 50% crash like 08 at all. I think that's out of the ordinary. You might get 35% somewhere along the line. But if I'm looking at this from a standpoint of history, valuations, leverage, the way the market is working right now, and how excited and over-exuberant everybody's been, I think we've hit the top for this cycle, and I think we're going to have a bear market between now and next October, and we'll see if I'm right. I don't think I'm going to end up having to change my opinion this time. Last time I thought, well, I must have missed it. Now I'm saying, hey, maybe I'm right all along. Anyway, and it's not just for my ego I'm saying that. The point is, I really feel like it's been right all along. I just was early, and that tends to almost always be the way these newsletters are. So anyway, if you haven't gotten on the mailing list yet, go to cornerstonereport.com, get on the mailing list, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Michael.
All right, and again, if you'd like to reach out for a free consultation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-327-4285, 800-327-4285.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone can help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.